Welcome to the 21st episode of The Whistleblowers, our guest-heaviest episode ever. I'm Luke Decock. With me, as always, John Clockerty. We have an interview. Tim Nestor is going to join us, former ACC referee who actually had to step down as a referee because of a promotion at his day job. One of the very few, I think, refs at that level, and correct me if I'm wrong here, John, who was actually working a full-time job during the season, a time-intensive full-time executive job while working a full ACC schedule.
That's
okay,
right.
Good.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
David Guthrie, and former NC State baseball player, now an NBA referee, got the chance last weekend to work the NBA All-Star Game in Charlotte, where he has lived in the past and will live again in the future. His wife is from there. His in-laws are there, lots of friends and family. Big kind of homecoming return for him. I spoke with him before the All-Star Game. We're going to play a few snippets of that conversation, kind of a fascinating conversation, including, I think you'll enjoy this too, John, why he thinks he progressed as an NBA referee, what he learned the most, what helped him the most ascending the ladder. Mm. So that's an interesting conversation.
Yeah.
We'll get into that. But first, before we do anything else, and we have issues to talk about. We've got some things from the Duke-Carolina game we want to talk about, things that happened there, and also, if you want to get on your phone or whatever and look up ESPN's big piece on Tim Donaghy and the NBA Donaghy gambling scandal, fascinating investigative piece about the gambling ring that Donaghy was associated with and the investigation into whether he did or did not, how much he did or did not affect the games that he was and his partners were gambling on. We're going to talk a lot about that, and that will also bring us to a discussion I think that a lot of listeners have asked for about, can referees really affect the outcomes of games? That's all coming up. Terrific podcast today, I promise you. But I want to bring on right now our special guest, former ACC referee Tim Nestor. Tim was a longtime ACC referee who stepped down last year. Well, I'll let Tim tell the story because he can probably tell it better than I can. Tim, thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, guys, thanks for having me.
Yeah, Tim, I've written down a few things here that I thought I'd ask you. But even before I get into that, I want to say that, you know, when I became the supervisor, you were on the staff. I didn't hire you. You were already part of the ACC staff. And if there was, and I mean this totally, if there was one official that I thought that through my 11 years tenure just kept getting better and better and better to the point in the last 4 or 5 years, I felt like I could put you in any game, feel comfortable with any partners, regardless of the level of that particular game, who was playing. You worked yourself to a position where I says, I'm gonna put Tim in these semifinals and these finals of the ACC. And I just thought every part of your game, Tim, got better. Just got, you know, and maybe you were that good and I didn't recognize it, but I certainly thought the last 4 or 5 years you were as good as just most anybody I had on the staff.
Reflection. And so my 22 years in the ACC, 26 years of doing college, you know, my approach to my officiating career was always a dual path approach. You know, I had a great job, and I was looking to advance my career professionally in my job, but I also considered, you know, everything that I did from a basketball officiating perspective to be, you know, an important part of trying to be the best I could be in that position as well. And, you know, one of the biggest things that I think I learned along the way was it's a marathon, it's not a sprint. And so, you know, going through experiencing situations, learning from those situations, and then trying to build upon that going forward, I think was my approach. You know, I tried to do the best job that I could. Obviously, I wasn't perfect. No referee is. But it's, you know, there's so many elements to being a good official. In addition to the play calling, in terms of, you know, what sort of partner are you? What's your ability to communicate? And I can tell you without question, I probably learned learned from both sides of my careers, if you will, things that allowed me to be successful as I took those and applied them on the other side.
Well, go ahead.
Complimentary. No, go ahead.
That's a great place to kind of jump to why you're not refereeing now, because you are a guy who, you know, unlike some of the guys who try to do it full time, carried on a really time consuming and patent heavy, as far as I can tell, career in a completely different industry, which obviously ended up leading you out of officiating eventually. So can you tell us a little bit about that process and kind of how you were able to manage your two careers while this was going on, and how hard was it in the end to kind of say, I've got to focus on this?
Sure. It was, you know, going fast forwarding to the end, it was very difficult to come to that decision. But, you know, at the end of the day, I was fortunate enough to work for a company that did allow me to leverage my vacation time. Obviously, due to technology, which wasn't there when I first started officiating, but having cell phones and laptops and things that allowed me to do some level of my work remotely also played a role in being able to kind of balance those efforts. I had always made it very clear with every supervisor that I worked for, and John and I had many discussions on this, you know, I have a job that I wanted to maintain as my primary source of my career, but I loved officiating, and I wanted to be able to complement that and try to advance within it as well. Having said that, though, that meant I had to limit myself. You know, I wasn't willing to necessarily join a bunch of conferences and go all over the country, because I knew I would not be able to balance both of those careers. Looking back on it, I would say you learn every 5 a.m. flight in the country that allows you to get back to the office. And you know, I would always say sometimes sleep is overrated. But it did make it difficult because, you know, unlike going from town to town, the way some of the guys were able to do it and getting into the hotel room and getting a good rest, sometimes it was hard for me to be able to do that because I was having, you know, to work during the day and things of that nature. So as my career advanced within my business, professional life, it did become more difficult, and obviously being in the office became a more critical element of what I needed to do, as well as travel. Unfortunately, I started to put supervisors in situations where I had emergency business travel that I had to tend to, and I had to come off games. And that's not easy on them, and I knew I was causing a strain on them. And while John and everybody else that I worked for, as supervisors of officials, were understanding because they knew where I was coming from, and I would never come off a game unless it was absolutely, you know, critical that I had to do that from a business perspective. But it became unfair to them, and it was a little bit too difficult to try to balance. And so I got offered a new role at a global level last season. And so as we were kind of working through what that was going to entail, I knew it meant I'd have to come off the floor. And I withheld that from everyone for the entire, I'd say half of the season. Once it was all understood, I began to become aware of it in December of last year. We finalized it in February. And I told everybody at the tournament I was coming off the floor. And I didn't even tell supervisors until just before for the tournament as well, because it was a hard conversation to have. It was very emotional, as you can say. This becomes a part of your life. It becomes who you are. But the biggest thing that was really sobering to me was the fact that I knew all the friendships that I have built over the years, it was going to be more difficult to maintain them because I wouldn't see them. Yeah. You know, that's the biggest thing that I miss. It's been great to hear from guys throughout the course of the season. You know, thinking of you, just, you know, you popped in my mind, how you doing, calls and texts. And so from that perspective, I know I left the court the right way, because people still actually want to talk to me. you know, even this week, I got a text from a guy who was sitting in the hotel room, and as you know, with the big game last night, a lot of past Duke Carolina games were being shown, and it's like watching you on the TV. So my response was, hopefully I didn't mess it up too badly.
Yeah. So. Hey, Tim, just one question. Had you not gotten that promotion, that global thing, do you think you would have still been officiating? Would you been able to manage it? Or did the promotion, was that the last straw that pushed you out?
Yeah, I think that was probably the last straw, John. But to be honest, it was becoming more and more difficult. And even without it, I'm not sure how much longer I would have been able to juggle. And, you know, I knew at the end of the day, you know, this is a business, and both sides of things are a business. And if you had to make a choice, I knew which side of that the businesses I would have to choose.
Right. Well, all right, Luke.
Well, I want to ask Tim. So obviously, you kind of saved the news till late in the season, but if I remember correctly, you ended up having one of the strangest farewell tours, even in that sort of abbreviated time frame. So after the ACC, let's talk a little bit about the ACC tournament first. So did you end up working a semi or a final, or the final?
Final.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So had you worked the championship game before?
Yes.
Okay, so that wasn't the first time. So you go from there to Charlotte.
Correct.
And what happened there?
Well, I just happened to be part of a 16 seed beating a 1 seed with the UNBC and Virginia game.
And so, I mean, obviously, you know, at some point in that game that this could be a historic event. At what point did that realization kind of, and does it sink into your head, or does the buzzer sound and you're like, oh man, like, what was that like for you?
Well, I guess the magnitude of that win by UMBC wasn't really on your mind during the game. Having officiated, you know, Virginia games for many years and worked games for Tony's teams, you know, you knew how well disciplined they were. You knew how they, you know, they never wavered in terms of doing what they do, and they do it very well. But as the game went on, you started to ask yourself, what's going on here? This is not the Virginia team that I'm used to seeing. And then at the same time, give UMBC all the credit in the world. Everything went their way. They shot unbelievably well and just played with a level of confidence. But even at halftime, I think Virginia was down a handful, maybe six or so. You just said, well, okay, you know, you're just waiting for Virginia to do the Virginia thing. And then as the second half went on, there was this kind of weird feeling in the arena where, is this really happening? And then, you know, as it got down in the last few minutes, and at that point, you know, the lead had grown significantly, and I think it had even reached a 20-point margin at one point in time. It was almost surreal to kind of see that unfold. And then it really wasn't until after the game do you realize you're part of history.
Yeah.
So that part of it really doesn't occur until after. It was really just the oddity of the way the game played out is what struck me during the game.
And, I mean, when you get your assignment for that weekend and you get the 16-1 game, I mean, I know no game's easy, but you kind of, I would imagine of all the games you go into thinking, I'm prepared for what's about to happen, a 16-1 game is kind of as good as you're going to get in that regard.
Well, historically speaking, you would think so, absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, every NCAA game, and I've had, you know, upsets in the NCAA before, obviously not to that magnitude. I mean, the very first NCAA game that I ever worked, Vermont upset Syracuse.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, anything can happen, obviously, in the tournament, and it has, and that's what makes the tournament so great. But, you know, at the end of the day, you just try to prepare for the game, and you never know what's going to, you know, be presented to you. And that's true throughout the regular season as well as every tournament game. If you go into it with a preconceived perception of what's sure. going to happen, that's when you're going to get surprised and bad things are going to happen. So you just have to take whatever's presented and work it.
Good point. Great point.
John's over here nodding approvingly. And, you know, I'm the idiot who asks these questions like that. But, John, yeah, you won some – not that it matters anymore, but you won some points with John. So that should have been, I guess, the big finish – but then I check your 2019 schedule, and apparently the news of your retirement was considerably overblown.
Well, you know, one of the things that I had talked to Brian Kersey about when I son, who's 23, he'll be 24 in a couple months. He's a graduate student. Garrett began refereeing and kind of following in the footsteps, if you will, when he was in high school, doing, you know, rec games and things of that nature. And then he went on and played football in college as a punter, but he continued to referee as well. And so he's now in his third season of Division III basketball, and he also got an opportunity to work some Division I games. And one of the things that I had always told him, he had always asked of me, he said, "Dad," he said, "you've got to stick around long enough," because he knew that things were probably coming to an end with my ability to continue to referee. He said, "Dad, you got to make me a promise, and that is, you got to stay around long enough for us to be able to work a game, and be able to, you know, work together and be on the floor in some situation." So that's exactly what we were able to do this year, and we went down and worked a tournament in November in Jamaica, and it ended up being, you know, kind of a father-son situation, as Jamie Lucky and Randy Stines and their sons, that are also in the officiating business now, we all got to go down there. And so that was a great, great time to be able to kind of celebrate with both father, sons, and other combinations, and do it in a not so bad setting, being down in Jamaica as well.
That's really cool.
Yeah, that is cool. I, of course, I've had a chance to referee with Tim, so I know exactly the kind of things, emotional things that you experienced refereeing with your son, Tim. That's really cool.
Yeah. So that was that's the extent. I did tell the guys, so, you know, I think I could get a few more years of doing two games a season.
Exactly. I know that.
I think John still wants to do two games a season.
Yeah, you know, I told a guy just recently, when they go to four men, I'm kind of thinking about coming back. I continue to work out just in case Kersey needs me.
Well, with the consortium now, they may need you in a big South game next
week.
That's
right.
So you never
know.
Tim, when you look back, I think you said 22 years in the ACC and 26 overall.
Yeah.
What are your fondest kind of memories of that career arc, and do you miss it?
Well, you know, that's been the thing that I've probably been asked more so in the last year than anything, and is, do you miss it? You know, I miss the people. There's no question about that. I've intentionally not watched a lot of games this season. One, it's been crazy busy, and I've also, you know, taken some of that time and not only given it back to my wife and spending time with her, and she's been fantastic and supportive, and it's been an adjustment for me to be home, obviously, in the winter, because that's not what she's used to. But I've also joined some boards on some nonprofits, just trying to engage in the community a little bit more now that I am home in the wintertime and aren't running off God knows where to referee basketball games. But I have intentionally and purposefully not watched a lot of games. You know, last night I couldn't help myself. Obviously, I had to watch the Duke Carolina game, and I'm out in San Francisco on business, so it ended up being early. But I got to watch all the first half and a good bit of the second half before I had to go to a dinner last night. And I just felt myself, the adrenaline just kind of building up in me, and that's the feeling that you miss, that being on the floor and getting, you know, getting a rise and just being part of moments that, you know, people remember. That's what you miss. You miss that from an emotional perspective, but most importantly, I miss the relationships with you know, the fellow officials, the supervisors, the coaches, and the players. That was the one thing that I always tried to do and maintain, was to build those relationships, not because I thought it would do me any favors. It's just a matter of, you know, conducting business. It's always easier to conduct business if you have some sort of a relationship, whether it's good or bad. At least if you have one, you know where you stand. And so that's the biggest part. we'll see. You know, Brian and I have talked about at some point me coming into a training sort of role within the conference, and it's something I think I'd love to be able to do. And but right now, I think I just need to take a little step back and separate myself. But I'll probably watch a few more games as the rest of the season unfolds, and obviously when the tournament rolls around. But that's kind of how I've dealt with it this season.
And I trampled over that. I think everyone was more interested in whether or not you miss it. I trampled over my own question there with, what was your fondest memory? You know, if there was a game or an event or a moment or a crew you worked with or where you worked that stands out after all this time.
Wow. You know, there's so many things that come to mind, and nothing really rises up above. You know, I think one of the great memories that I'll have is having worked the, and John can remember this, I was part of the crew that worked the last carrier game out in San Diego on the Midway. And it was a game that almost didn't happen because it was scheduled to be opening night. And I think that night was one of the 10 days in the year that it actually rained in San Diego. And so they had to push it 2 days and work on Saturday. Well, as you all know, you know, we're moving on to our next games, and John had to work through a lot of difficulties and changes of scheduling, but I'm glad we were able to do that because that was an unbelievable experience, and then ultimately it turned out to be the last carrier game sure. that was ever played. So, you know, that type of memory, some of the great classic games that, you know, to be a part of the Duke Carolina, having worked that many times, you know, just how those games unfold, and I don't think I ever had one that wasn't, you know, down to the buzzer. So I could go on and on and on, but that's just some of the things that just come to the top of my head.
Was there an ACC tournament in there anywhere that stood out for you?
Well, obviously the first final you ever work.
Sure. When was that?
That was I can't even remember the year, Luke, but Virginia beat Duke in that final, whatever year that was.
Okay.
And that was Virginia's, Tony's first tournament championship.
Tim, just one thing. The longer you're out of it, two things. First of all, you'll miss it less the longer you're out of it. The relationships will still be there. And when somebody asks you about a game that they saw you work, you're going to even have a hard time recalling it. that's just part about being out of it.
Yeah. I knew that game sounded familiar. That was 2014 in Greensboro. And I think I remember asking you on press row when you came out if that was your first final.
There you go.
So everything, I couldn't remember either. So that's my fault too. But
the oddity of all this has been, you know, my wife has gotten a better understanding of just how, you know, how avid fans are, because when we're out and about, and it's not necessarily out and about near where we live, we've been out of state, and people have come up to me and say, "Do you miss refereeing?" And she's like, "Do people really care who you guys are?"
Yeah. I do, and John, maybe you have some perspective on this. It's funny you bring that up. I feel like that's an internet-enabled thing, that people, that you know, you're kind of the box scores, people, the tracking of where guys have worked, Twitter, all that stuff has just kind of made college basketball officials in particular. I think the NBA guys always were. You know, they had the personalities and, you know, Earl Strom and those guys. But I feel like college officials have become a little more recognizable than they used to be.
Well, you know, people are interested in for whatever reason, how many games does a referee work, how many conferences they work in. You know, they're tracking officials all the time. And I think, Luke, to answer your question, I think there was more personalities back probably in my era, even before that. You know, people bring up guys like Lou Bello and Charlie Ekman, and these guys had their individual personalities. Today, you look for officials very much like Tim that could be a partner in any crew and know that, you know, we still have some of those flamboyant guys. I don't need to bring up their names, but, you know, they like to have the attention more so than most officials. But, Yeah, I just think you're right. I mean, there's so much exposure on the internet, and
well, and just as many games are on TV.
That's a great point too.
Yeah,
you know, there's just
every game's on TV. That's right. That's right.
Maybe in the old days, the same refs always worked the TV games that were on.
True. Yeah. Well, first of all, quite honestly, when I was back, and it was a long time ago, there was one or two games. C.D. Chesley was sponsoring a game of the week. Do you remember that, Tim? Where?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Sail with the Pilot.
Sail with the Pilot.
And I tell you, now every game, there's not a game that's ACC game that's not on TV.
Tim, I guess given your roots here and all that stuff, you're probably going to miss Raycom as a part of growing up and a part of the ACC as much as anybody.
Absolutely, and the guys that have been part of that network, the TV talent that worked the games, fantastic people to work with, from the producers to the commentators, and while it's a bittersweet, obviously, you know, it's the right thing to do for the league. I hope the best for all of those guys because they help make ACC basketball what it is.
Yeah,
that's right. That's a good point. You know, there's a lot of good guys out there that probably we won't see or hear once the network comes up.
Yeah, and I actually had a talk with Jimmy Rayburn about that last night, about kind of what Raycom becomes next year. And it's probably going to be more of a production company. So, Tim, like a lot of the people that you and I would see behind the scenes at the scorer's table or whatever will probably still be around in the ACC network era, but it'll be different. And for people who don't know, this is a very North Carolina sort of thing we're talking about. The ACC's first real television deal was the syndication by C.D. Chesley, really the first college basketball TV deal that wasn't like a national game of the week, and that really is what built the ACC into a regional powerhouse. So there's your basketball / television history lesson for today. Tim knows it by heart. John knows it by heart.
I can remember Jim. Was it Jim Thacker and Billy Packer?
Oh yeah,
they were
the
two guys that did the games, and it was only a game or two, no more than that. But
a really under. If you're not in this area, I didn't grow up in the ACC area. I kind of had to learn about all this, but once you do, you really understand the role that this television operation played in growing the ACC into what it is today, to where, you know, they're playing in Brooklyn. There's a straight line, that takes you there and to all these millions of dollars. So, and Tim being sort of in the footprint, so to speak, both as a person and as a referee, not to say those two things are different, but Tim, there's one other thing I wanted to ask you about, and we do have, I mean, I think a decent part of our listening base on this podcast is not just people who listen out of obligation to John and me, but I do hear occasionally from young referees and people like that who have questions for John and want advice. You actually were able to make this work, being a big-time college referee and keeping an important, time-intensive day job. That's a question I hear a lot from sort of guys in junior college, D3, high school, trying to work their way up, is how can they find that balance till they get to the point where they can try to maybe make a go of this? What was the secret for you?
I'd say it's, you know, don't overextend yourself. Don't put yourself in a situation where you're going to jeopardize your job too early in your officiating career. And that's because you never know how things are going to work out. And as a result, you know, that may mean you need to limit yourself to some degree, but you can manage within it. You don't have to work a dozen leagues in order to build your credibility and build your experience and be noticed. I'm sure John can jump in on this, but he knew the other officials that were working in other leagues and who he might be interested in bringing into the ACC. So, you know, you don't have to splatter your face all over the place in order to be seen, is my point. The second point being, you know, you have to be honest and upfront, both with your employer as well as your supervisors. And if you try to be secretive and play them off of one another, then that's a disaster waiting to happen. Obviously, when I started coming up, the financials certainly were not where they were by the time I left. So it was going to be very difficult, and very few people at that time were trying to do this as a full-time situation. having said that, that dynamic has changed, but you still, it doesn't happen overnight, and you've got to build up the you know, your reputation and your ability to work at a high level in order to sustain yourself solely in that sort of arena. So that doesn't happen overnight, so therefore you've got to figure out that balance. It can be done, and it should be done, quite frankly, because I've seen too many guys get hurt early and without any source of income. It's not a good place to be. So don't put your family at risk, because while you should be chasing your dreams, you can't let it be at the expense of other things. So that's just kind of my advice. That's what I've been directing my son to do. I certainly am encouraging him to pursue this. I actually discouraged him to do it at first, because I wanted to see if he wanted to do it for himself or if he wanted to do it just because I did. And so he's decided that he wants to give it a shot. But I told him all along, you're going to get a job. He's in graduate school. He's getting his graduate degree. He's going to get a job. And I said, and then let's see what happens. So that's what I would say to guys trying to do the balance thing, is you should. Don't put all your eggs in one basket until you've kind of gotten to a point where you can make that decision.
That sounds like good advice for
great,
anyone.
Great advice, really. Tim. Yeah. That's good stuff. Yep.
Tim, thank you so much for joining us. I know your schedule is obviously unbelievably busy, or we'd be seeing you on the basketball court. I definitely think I at least have missed seeing you around and working games with a steady hand. And best of luck to you in this full time endeavor now. And we appreciate your time.
Well, thanks for having me, guys. It's always great to talk about officiating and talk to you guys as well. And best of luck with the podcast, and I do appreciate you having me on.
Thanks, Tim. It's always good to talk to you.
All right. Take care, guys.
Thanks, Tim.
That was terrific.
That was great.
I thought. Tim, I always thought, I mentioned this sort of in the interview, I always thought watching him officiate, and obviously I'm an idiot when it comes to this stuff, but he just had a really steady hand. He just calm, consistent, even-tempered, even-keeled. Not real flashy or flamboyant. Maybe his numbers weren't quite as good as some other guys who were higher profile, but just like your absolute rock kind of type of official.
Steady Eddie. And he was the same every game, whether it was the Duke Carolina game, Luke, or maybe a mid-level ACC game, what I call mid-level, or even at the bottom. But Tim's effort, you never question. And he was a great partner. All the officials that I had liked him as a partner, and he always held up his own. And I think the best how to identify Tim is just he was steady every night, and you know his calls were good. He learned the game. He worked at it. I think he mentioned that it was a process, but. When I came into the league as a supervisor, I don't think Tim was nearly as good as he was the last 5 years. So he worked at it. He probably studied his games and found out the areas that he was weak at and improved. But at the end of his career, he was just about as good as anybody I had.
That's interesting. I mean, it sounds like when you took the job and you were looking at your roster, Tim Nestor was not a guy really on your radar, and that he worked his way into your good graces. And I mean, I think that's a lesson for all of us, that hard work and dedication. I mean, I've had bosses. I had a conversation the other day with one of the greatest bosses I've ever had, who when he took the job, and this is not in Raleigh, this is way in my past, he said offhandedly the other day, if I'd listened to what people said when I got there, you know, I wouldn't have given you the chances you got, which was a little shocking to me because I was pushing hard for this. But the point being, you know, if we do these things right and we work hard and we get better, we can win over people who maybe aren't even, you know, aren't predisposed to think we're that good, and maybe make them realize we are.
Yeah. Tim was I refereed with Tim Nestor. And when I came into the supervisor's job, I didn't have the highest opinion of Tim Nestor. But, and he may have felt that, but I had several guys in front of him that I thought, you know, were better. But again, to Tim's credit, at the end of his career, and not just the last year, but the last 5 years, Tim was excellent. And, you know, and he did that himself. He figured out, you know, do I have to be more aggressive? Do I, you know, do I have to be a better play caller? All of those things, because Tim Nesser's the kind of guy that probably his mentality was, if I'm not getting better and if I'm not improving, I'm going the other way.
Sure.
Okay. There's a standard that he felt like he had to get to, and by gosh, he got to it. There's no question. I had 16 coaches, and not one of them wasn't. They were all happy to see Tim Nesser show up.
Like, if you gave a vote of your coaches, like a yay nay vote on all your referees, they're all going to say yay on him.
On him.
Yeah. No, he worked the last. Either a semi or a final in the ACC tournament. The last four or five.
I had nine referees, and for the semifinals and the finals, and Tim was one of those nines every year.
Sure.
You know,
yeah. Just metronomic in that respect. And obviously, there's a few core guys who you can say that about in the ACC as well. Brian Kersey was one before he moved into the big chair. But
add to that, Luke, and when you're dealing with a lot of referees, some of them are complicators and some are simplifiers. And Tim was probably a simplifier for me. He took every game I gave him, never questioned the games. He was a great guy to have on the staff, and I wish I had more of those kind of guys.
Yeah. I'm a complicator, just for the
record. You're not a complicator.
I'm a complicator. You can ask my boss. So we're recording this the day after the Duke Carolina game, where Zion Williamson blew a tire. Almost literally, when he stepped through his shoe and hurt his other knee, really changed the dynamic of that game. You and I, before we sat down to record, went over a couple sort of little peculiarities. Just sort of incidents from that game that had been raised to a certain extent, you know, sort of on social media or whatever. So there was a flagrant foul call. It actually happened right in front of me, and I didn't see it. A common foul followed by a monitor review and the addition of a flagrant foul. Did you see it on replay? Was there anything there that you noticed that was going on there?
Look, I did see it on replay, and I'm not surprised you didn't see it, because there was three referees out there that didn't see it either when it happened. But when they replayed it, I was in agreement with the officials. It looks like the Carolina kid, in an effort to get away or to continue to go up the floor, and he reaches out and pulls his arm back. Obviously, that's what happened, because he did catch the guy in the eye and split the guy's a small split. But I thought the ruling was right. That's not a play you want to take to the level of a flagrant two. A flagrant one, you get some free throws and you get the ball at midcourt. And I thought they adjudicated it correctly, but I did see it, and again, I didn't see it happen. I sat here and said that I think that's a nothing play. Then when they replayed it, I would have agreed with the three referees that probably was a flagrant one.
Yeah, and when I say I didn't see it, I didn't mean that I didn't think there was anything going on there.
Right.
I'm saying it happened right in front of me, and I missed
it.
Yeah, I just literally didn't see it.
Right.
So there didn't seem like Roy was complaining a little bit, I think. I'm not sure it was about that or whatever. He had an extended conversation with one of the officials during the free throw process. And
I wonder what his thought would have been after he had a really good look at it.
Okay, you know? maybe.
Yeah.
The other thing from that game that happened that people raised questions about, Duke made a basket. Carolina had a quick inbounds, hit Kenny Williams for a home run pass down the court, and it was whistled dead for a Duke dead ball timeout. Just curious what you saw there. In the building, I mean, I understand this is almost like the hockey thing where the referee intends to blow the whistle and the play is dead there, so it's no goal. It did seem like a very quick timeout there. Is that reality or what?
They never showed Coach Williams and how he responded to it or how he reacted. But when I saw the play, I thought the officials made a mistake, because the rule says once the ball is in the possession of the thrower and he is in making an effort to throw the ball in, you cannot grant the opposing team a timeout. And anybody that knows Carolina knows that they are going to take that ball right out of the hoop as fast as they can
and
get it up the court. And when they threw that pass, certainly they had Duke at a big-time disadvantage. But they did grant the timeout. But by rule, I don't think they can grant that timeout. Not once that guy has the ball. And as soon as he gets it, he's throwing it. Okay, it wasn't like there was a delay. He got it and he started to throw it. And once he starts, has the ball, and what they call change of status is about to occur, can't grant the timeout.
Okay, and there was one other thing in that game, not necessarily limited to that game. There was one call I thought fell in this category. And someone else we had a Twitter question about this, the so-called wait and see foul, where the guy goes to the rim and the ball's hanging on the rim, and then the ball falls off the rim, and then we got a foul. Then the arm goes up. I feel like that's kind of a veteran thing, that's like an old-school way, that if the ball goes in, you let it go. If it doesn't, you call the foul.
I don't remember that play, but your take on it is as old-school is probably right. Because if the ball goes in, they ignore the foul. If the ball comes off the ring, they can take the foul. I think you know, I probably refereed a lot of plays like that, but I think you're going down a slippery slope when you do that.
I mean, it's discouraged now, right?
I think there's a risk in that, okay? But again, I don't remember the play, but Luke, I thought there was a play that they called basket interference in that game that did not appear to be basket interference. It appeared that the ball had come off the ring.
Interesting. I did not notice that.
Yeah. And it was early in the first half.
Interesting. Yeah. Overall, though, not to nitpick, I did think it was a pretty well officiated game overall.
Yeah. You know, Luke, you were there, and when I go back and look at the game while I was watching it, I said to myself, you know, there's a lot to be said by veteran players who have played in that game before and have experience. And I think about the nights that Cam Johnson and Luke May had, terrific nights. And I just think experience and having been on that big stage, not that Barrett had a big night, but I just... You know, I know that I know how important Zion would have been, but also I thought that Carolina ran their offense and got a lot of inside baskets, and I think it came from some experience, and then Cam Johnson's hitting threes. I think about the freshman that Carolina has. Kobe White, he looked out of sorts. He's trying to force everything. He has six turnovers. He made one out of six threes. Maybe the night, maybe the stage was too big for him.
A couple of thoughts there. One, obviously, Zion going out changes the entire temperature, you know, landscape, geology of that game. I did think that Carolina played the game it had to play to beat Duke with or without Zion. If Zion had been in the game the way Carolina played, they got good matchups for May and Brooks. Cam Johnson shot the ball well, mid-range. Obviously, Carolina had a tough night from three. And maybe Carolina can't beat Duke with Zion shooting 2-for-20 from three. But I think everything else that Carolina did served, that would have served them well whether Zion was in the game or not. And not to pat myself on the back, my column Wednesday morning was as good as Kobe White and Trey Jones have been. This is a crucible unlike any other, and that can be hard on freshmen point guards especially. And I thought Trey Jones was fine defensively, but obviously struggled on offense. Okay. Kobe White was out of sorts. UNC needed Seventh Woods, who has not had a great season, to kind of come off the bench and give them a real spark at the point at times. So that didn't necessarily surprise me about that game. The Kobe White, Trey Jones thing, that's like... Coaches give freshman point guards a lot more responsibility than they used to. We see it a lot more. And that's just part of the accelerated process of recruiting and development in the college game. That's just the way it is now. You can't wait for players to develop. You got to get them going and get them going. But it's still Duke Carolina and Cameron. I mean, either the first Duke Carolina game of your career is hard.
No.
It's going to be hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard for a freshman point guard.
Great.
And
so we agree on all those things.
We always agree, John.
No,
come on.
Absolutely. But, you know, Kobe White's taking that ball in, and he's hoping that the officials, he's trying to force the action into big guys, hoping that the officials are going to blow the whistle and get him to the line. And he ends up laying on the floor. And
it wasn't just big guys. Trey Jones blocked his shot at least once.
Yeah, you're right.
You know? So, one other issue not UNC Duke related from a game this week. I don't know if you saw this or not. The Georgia-Mississippi State game.
I did see it.
Georgia got called for a technical foul for object thrown on the floor. Tom Crean said they never got a warning. Was that handled correctly? And here's your hypothetical. What if it's visiting fans throwing stuff on the floor?
You assume that it was coming from not Mississippi State, but Georgia, since they were playing at Georgia. But who knows? But, you know, that's a hypothetical. I don't know. But I will say that the SEC has always had a policy that if something is thrown on the floor, that there should be a warning and followed by a technical foul if it happens again. Are we sure that at some point in that game there wasn't something thrown on the floor and that there was a warning?
Yeah, I'm just going by what Crean said in his press conference,
he said he wasn't warned.
Yeah, I believe that's what I saw.
Yeah, maybe.
And that's
so.
Why he was so angry.
Yeah. Well, you know, I know Ben Holland was asking for a technical foul and he got it. I saw that. You know, I had a situation years ago where Florida played Vanderbilt, and Florida had a good team, as Vanderbilt did, and they threw tennis balls out on the floor early in the game. And
Dwayne Shinsius.
Thank you. And we had a warning, and then when Vanderbilt thought they had the game iced, here comes another tennis ball, and we put Wayne Shinsius in. It turned the game around, and Florida ended up winning, in which the game was actually in the pocket of Vanderbilt.
Interesting. Had a question, reader question, about crew chiefs, referees, and umpires, and all that kind of stuff. So one official is the referee.
Correct.
The other two are the umpires.
Right.
How is that determined, and what responsibilities are different?
Well, when the assignment is made, the supervisor designates who's going to be the referee, who will be U1 and who will be U2. Each one of them has equal responsibility. One's not going to take precedent over the other. But if there is an administrative issue that has to be straightened out, that the referee is in charge and should be the guy that adjudicates it in the other two. But as far as calling there's no difference in their responsibilities. The referee has some other responsibilities as far as administrative stuff, but the supervisor will designate that as they go into the game.
Are there certain guys who are better?
Oh, yes.
As referee?
Oh, yes.
What distinguishes them?
I don't know. Just some guys, I will say, you know, let me, Teddy Valentine is a great, outstanding referee. I don't think he would ever care whether he was a referee or not. It's not his schlick to be a referee. As being opposed to the umpire. He could be the strongest referee in that crew and still be the U1 or U2.
He doesn't care.
You know, a guy like Mike Eads or Roger Ayers, take a young crew out there, they want to be they want to be in charge. They want to be the.
So when they're mentoring.
Yeah, mentoring things.
What if those two guys are in the same crew?
It's a toss up.
It just doesn't matter.
Neither one cares. No.
Yeah. Okay.
No, neither one cares.
So this is something I learned. It's not necessarily the referee who throws up the jump ball.
That is correct. But I was in the mechanics manual, it is the referee that is designated to throw it up, but they always allow if Teddy you'll never see Teddy throw the ball up.
Okay, here's what I was told. This is official, off the record scuttlebutt. The guy who throws the ball up is the one who's the tallest and can get the ball in the air and can get out of the way the fastest.
Well, I had never heard that, but during my tenure as a referee, some of the best tossers were small guys.
Well, you're probably biased a little bit.
Lenny Wartz was one of the great tossers.
Your bias is showing. There's no doubt about that. Yeah. So does that affect crew dynamics at all typically?
Sometimes. Sometimes. There's another official that... for whatever reason, he was a veteran, he was in the league, but I wasn't putting him in a position as the referee. And he took serious issue with it and, says, John, you obviously don't trust me. I've been around, da da da. And I'm disappointed that you put younger guys, less experience in the referee's position. So it does bother some referees.
Interesting. Well, let's turn away from college for a second, although David Guthrie did work some college games. He came up with your son, Tim, when they were both getting started. David Guthrie went to NC State. He played baseball, 1 year of baseball there after transferring from junior college, went into the minor leagues, played in the Cincinnati organization, and then on Sunday worked the NBA All-Star Game in Charlotte, where his wife is from and where he has lived and will live again. And I had the chance leading up to the All-Star game to speak with David at length on the phone. We actually have several mutual friends, including some loyal listeners of this podcast. And I'll play a couple snippets of that conversation that I found interesting.
You said you got started in officiating while you were still playing minor league baseball. At what point, why and at what point did that become serious?
You know, I went to, I started going to some camps, referee camps, pretty much like every referee that gets going. And you get the bug early on, you really do. And the challenge of wanting to be better at it and things of that nature. And so one of the camps I went to, when I was first getting started was a Coast to Coast referee school, which the NBA is constantly scouting. In the officiating department, they're constantly scouting, looking for prospects, looking for people that they feel like they can put into their minor league system that, they can try to work with and develop to potentially become NBA referees. And it's a long process. So when I first went to that camp and was exposed to some of that teaching and, breaking down video and being around some of the guys that were NBA referees, really sparked my interest amazingly. And, after doing that, reffing for another year or two, they asked me to go to summer training, which, is now just completely exploded with the way it's in Vegas and all that. But back then, it was not quite what it is nowadays. So anyway, I went to summer training and just got the bug. And they asked me if I wanted to go into the CBA at the time, the Continental Basketball Association, and worked a year in that. And it just kind of grew from there. So I have to peek and double check this, but I think I was 5 years maybe in the minor leagues. Combination of the CBA was 1 year, and then the D league total, in the minor leagues before I got hired full time in the NBA.
Did you do some college too?
I did a little bit of college. Yep, not as much. When I got going early on, I really had the goal and desire to kind of go to the NBA. That was really my desire. So I really put most of my energy and focus and availability on working those games predominantly. But I did do some college as well. It's kind of they kind of mesh together for referees that are coming through the training program of the NBA's training program and then also the colleges.
What was, as you were coming up, what was the critical thing for you that you think kind of helped you advance to this level?
Video was huge. And even back then, C- seeing yourself refereeing on video was huge back in that time. There wasn't the same amount of access as there is now for people. So if you could get like a VHS tape of your game, and a lot of times it would just be, you know, like the coaches tape from up in the top, you know, where they would tape way up high. Just getting that early on and seeing yourself and, you know, watching how you run, seeing how you look on video, it was huge in the development. And there's a lot of teaching and mentoring that goes on. You know, we'd go back to the hotel and watch the game on the video afterwards, and you're sitting there with, you know, I'm in my first year in the D League, or sorry, the G League now, with an NBA referee, you know, sitting down with you, breaking your tape down and kind of telling you, you know, this is what you need to work on. You need to do this better. This was a good decision. This was not a good decision. So it's just, I mean, hours and hours and hours and hours of videotape work. And that really fast forwards your development. And then now, obviously working the games as well.
Yeah. When you were getting started, was your dad doing the referees in the SEC? Is that kind of how the timing worked out, or did that kind of happen coincidentally?
Yeah, so my dad worked for the Southeastern Conference for a number of years, and he was a basketball coach.
Mm-hmm.
And you're familiar with Fred Bearcat, I'm sure, probably.
Sure, yeah.
Right, from back in the day. So he and Fred sort of had similar like timelines in the sense that they were both coaches. My dad coached at Georgia, coached at George Washington University. And back in those days, the people that handled the officiating, they were really all, most of them were coaches. So it was kind of a dual job back then. He was at that time when I was first starting out, he was still involved with the SEC and worked with the SEC and became involved with officiating through the college ranks, as well as all the other responsibilities that, you know, it was kind of almost like a director of basketball operations, which also included officiating back then. And as things have over time gone, it's officiating's always kind of branched off now in its own department with all the different colleges and everything. So it was influential with my dad being in that position, kind of, you know, sparking my interest and things like that, definitely.
Did you grow up, I mean, you were a baseball player, but were you a basketball player as well? Were you a two-sport athlete, or were you always baseball primarily?
In high school, I played basketball and baseball, and actually basketball was really my first love. That's what I loved to play most in high school predominantly. You know, just as it kind of – I kept playing, you know, throughout high school, it was just kind of evident that I had a little more – potential in baseball. So I sort of just started to focus on that more. But always loved hoops and was around it growing up.
How did you find out about your finals assignment, and then what was it like working that game and being a part of that?
In the playoffs, throughout the playoffs, we find out our assignments. Each round of the playoffs, it's a list that's emailed out. So that was the first way you find out. An email comes out with the list of the names of that are on there. And, I don't know. It was just a surreal feeling, amazing. I think I ran downstairs and, you know, just told my wife. And, you know, it was just it's really the pinnacle for us of what we're doing, reaching that level. So it just felt like an amazing accomplishment and felt so blessed. The game I worked game two out in Golden State. And so my wife, Laura, flew out for the game. I worked with Duke Callahan and Derek Stafford. So it was a great crew. Just an amazing experience. I mean, it really was.
How different is a finals game from, say, like a conference finals game? Is there a tangible difference even, like, when you walk in the door of the arena?
There's definitely more buzz. There's no doubt. The media is everywhere. You know, just the numbers of people
you know, that are on the floor in pregame warmups. I mean, you can't hardly move out on the floor because there's so many cameras and everything. So it's definitely, you know, a whole nother league for sure. You know, you just have to try to find, you know, that quiet place to get into and stick with your mechanics and your discipline and the fundamentals. And, you know, if you do that, it's just like anything in life, you know, you stick to those fundamentals, stick to your discipline that, you know, just makes things slow down for you. And so, yeah, there was a lot of nervous energy leading up to it. And once the ball went up and it was tipped off, you just try to dig in and it's just a game at that point and just go do it.
So video, that was his key coming up. He thought video really helped him move along and get to where he is now. He worked his first finals game last year. He worked game two of the NBA finals. And that, you know, that's like working the final four for a college official. You've made it.
Yep.
No matter what else happens, you've made it. So I appreciate David's time. He was a good sport about it. I had a column in the paper. You can read that online if you're interested. But, you know, interesting guy kind of coming up and choosing to go the NBA route. We talk a lot on this podcast about going the college route and how you can go the college route. And this is a guy who went full-time in the NBA and is loving it and having success.
Yes. And David did... get a lot of training early on in the college game, working small levels, but he always had the desire to be an NBA referee, even when he was working in college. And he took advantage of every opportunity, the NBA camps, the different camps, and you know, again, David, I think, is a made referee. Like you mentioned, he did a lot of studying, according to him, on films, finding out what they expected of him and how he could improve. And obviously, he did all the right things because he would not be in that position to work those NBA finals if he wasn't successful.
And his father, a former basketball coach at Georgia and other places, ended up becoming the SEC supervisor of officials, who was your son Tim was working for a while.
And I worked for him for 20 years. His dad.
And was your boss.
Oh, yeah. He was my boss. And he was a terrific guy. He passed away suddenly of a heart attack. But I refereed for 20 years in the SEC, and he was my boss.
Who was a better supervisor, you or him?
We had different personalities. There was times that he could be intimidating, and he managed sometimes by intimidating some of the referees, and I never felt like that was my personality. I could fire people too, but I don't think I ever got real angry. But Mr. Guthrie, he was a coach. I was never a coach. He was a coach at heart.
Let's stick with the NBA for a second. Big story this week. Really nice reporting by ESPN. In breaking down the Tim Donaghy scandal from sort of the Donaghy side of things, about how he got involved with these gamblers, how he ended up shaving points or trying to shave points, gambling on these games he was officiating. And the surprising thing to me was the degree to which the NBA seemed to want to shut down the investigation of how many games, and this is my take on it based on what was in the article, how many games he did bet on, and did he affect the results of those games? The NBA came to the conclusion that he did not. The article and its analysis of the data suggests that he did have an effect on those games, if not the outcome, certainly the score and the point spread, and had an effect on his crewmates. And he talks about it in this book about how he could call an illegal defense, obviously not something in college, but call an illegal defense early in the game to get a team off its rhythm, or bias his crew members into complaining about a player or whatever. I found it fascinating, and we can talk about the grand scope of those dynamics. But I did think it raises an interesting question, and one I get a lot from listeners of this podcast, is can officials really affect the outcome of a game?
Luke, it's not funny, but it's ironic that before you came and before we got set up, I made some notes about Tim Donaghy in the ESPN article, and some of the things that you just mentioned just jumped out at me that I thought, you know, I don't know who the NBA or Tim Donaghy expects to convince, But I'm taking a quote out of here from the NBA, and you've already mentioned this. The NBA told FBI, you can't fix a game in the NBA. It's impossible. And that's a quote. You know, Luke, I see that as nothing but damage control. That's all that is, because if the NBA doesn't think a rogue referee can't fix a game, they got their head in the sand. Because I will tell you, as a referee, if you could hook a if the gamblers, the whoever is doing it, if you can hook a referee up, he has a far better chance of fixing that game than any player. And there's been many, many players. That's not right. There's been players that have been arrested and convicted of fixing games. The only guy that I know or that I could think of that has ever been accused and arrested for fixing a game is Timmy Donaghy. I can't remember another referee. But saying that he would call an early illegal defense just to slow down the defense and let them play softer. He also mentioned that he would target big guys and get fouls on big guys early so they would go to the bench. If that's not having an influence on the outcome of the game, then what is the NBA talking about that you can't fix a game? You can absolutely fix a game if you want to as a rogue referee.
Did you ever have any suspicion that any of your guys were doing that?
No, I don't. And there are some calls that I would scratch my head on and say, why does he take that call at that time? But no, I absolutely not. Not in the 30 years I refereed or 11 years as supervisor.
You never got a sniff of anyone else doing it when you were on a crew? Okay.
No.
So any of those calls as a supervisor that you saw, you just attributed to incompetence?
Yeah, I mean, like, even sometime, Luke, that you would say, that play that he just called, that weak travel to give up the ball, that a team comes down and then there's a foul at the other end, you're saying, what in the heck? But no, did I ever think, I thought it was incompetence. I thought that was a bad call by a bad referee.
Well, we may have to revisit that at some point, but seems as good a place as any to stop. The answer being yes, if you think that Tim Donaghy wanted to fix outcomes of NBA games, he could.
Absolutely. I don't want to labor it, but how could the NBA or Tim Donaghy deny that I did these things, but that's not fixing games?
Right. That seems as good a place to stop as any. Certainly thought-provoking. You know, your belief being that if Tim Donaghy wanted to fix NBA games, he could.
He could. Contrary to what the NBA is putting out there, that they can't be fixed. I don't agree with that.
Be interesting to see as we get to a point where there's more legalized gambling, whether there's more scrutiny, whether there's better data, whether there's people tracking. The NBA may be tracking this stuff now the same way they tried to do an analysis of Donaghy's games, or the way that they should be doing it, the way ESPN did it. Tracking line movements was that associated with his games. It's a fascinating article, highly recommended if you have interest in basketball or officiating or just good old-fashioned mob stories, because the story told is fascinating. And you knew his father. You know,
I knew his father. Knew his I refereed father. With his father, sure. And it has affected his father. You know, when good friends of his father, which I was, but even closer friends from the Philadelphia area. His father has pretty much cut ties and moved away and to a Jersey Shore, I understand, and has not communicated with close friends of his. I think it's affected his whole family. His wife had to divorce him, and you know, but gambling's an addiction, and I guess he got. But the story is fascinating and worth reading.
Yeah, and you know, so that may be the darkest topic we've covered here. I think earlier in this podcast, some brighter stuff. Tim Nestor on the balance between officiating and the rest of his life and having to make that choice, but being secure with it and comfortable and being okay with walking away. And then David Guthrie and his success, climbing up through the ranks of the NBA to work a finals game, to work an all-star game in what's essentially his hometown now. Really kind of the brighter side of things. Guys who did it, Tim Nestor's case got better, done well. David Guthrie got better, got, you know, has entered this elite tier of NBA mm-hmm. officials, guys who have done well for themselves. So that's it for episode 21, our most guest-packed episode yet. And we'll see who we can come up with next week.
We're going to get
next time.
Yeah, I'm going to get one of our recognizable officials, possibly, or maybe even somebody from the ACC office that both Luke and I know, and see if they'll join us.
Can't imagine who that would be, but the suspense is killing me. Thank you very much for listening, and we will be back soon.